Hey guys, it's Thomas Frank here. I'm back on Walking the Floor with Chris Shiflett.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to episode 170 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. I say your favorite podcast, but for some of you, it might not be your favorite podcast for long because today it's a little diversion from our typical subject matter. We're going to be talking politics and history, and, you know, I totally get it that pisses a lot of people off, and you know, we're living through these polarized times and shit's fucking crazy out there. And if you don't want to hear it, I get it. Turn it off. Delete this episode from your phone, because we get into it. And I say we, me and my buddy Thomas Frank, who's one of my favorite writers. You can tell he's one of my favorite writers because he's been on my show more than any other person. This is his third appearance on Walking the Floor. If you don't know Tom, he writes about politics, and every time I talk to him, he actually swears he's never going to write about politics again, and I have stopped believing it because he's one of the best at it, in my opinion. I hate when people refer to, like, a book or an album or something as important, but for me, Tom's work is important. It's really important because he's a historian, so he gives you, like, the context you need to understand what our fearless leaders in Washington are doing and why and what might come next based on historical precedent and all that sort of thing. You might know Tom from books like What's the Matter with Kansas or my personal favorite, Listen Liberal. But today we get into the weeds on his new just-released book, The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. So for any of you folks out there who've been like, what is populism exactly? We're going to get into that right now. I should also mention, he's got a website, tcfrank.com, where you can find out whatever he's up to, whatever he's doing. And he's been out making the rounds, promoting his book, and he's been posting a lot of the, like, his appearances and stuff on his Twitter account, which is @ThomasFrank_. So without further ado, this is my good buddy Thomas Frank on Walking the Floor.
You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair.
So my dad,
I see your proud Kansas flag.
Yeah, well, you got the whole childhood bookshelf there.
Oh, my God, are we looking into your childhood room?
Yeah,
right,
this
now?
Is my room, yeah.
Whoa, where's the Lynyrd Skynyrd posters and whatnot?
All that's gone, and it was a Sex Pistols poster. And I had a Led Zeppelin wall
cred.
Hanging.
Punk cred.
Yeah. My daughter, the reason I mentioned that, my daughter found it the other day in my attic.
Shit.
Yes, and she took it to college. She was like, she found that in a Joy Division poster, and she left the Joy Division behind.
Wow, that's got to be worth something on eBay right
oh,
now.
Oh, no. It's all just bullshit. I also had a Led Zeppelin wall hanging in an earlier stage, nice. Earlier iteration of my personality.
Was that next to your dream catcher and your Bob Marley poster?
Ooh, stop.
Hey, Tom, okay, listen, I wanted to ask you, I've been curious. You have this, I've noticed this pattern over the years that I've known you, and that is you write a fantastic book and immediately declare you're never writing on politics again. That's
yes.
it. It's
Wait, are you
end.
Recording? Or have you turned it on? Have you turned it on?
Yeah. Oh, I'm recording.
Okay.
Yeah. That's where you get the good bits. You don't tell the. That's where you get the honest.
I was going to show you the rest of the stuff in this room, but now I'm not going to.
Oh, shit. well, just wait till we go offline. Yeah, but I've noticed that where you declare that you're never writing on politics again.
Because I'm so sick of it.
Well, but in years past, in those periods between books, you've maintained a column at like The Guardian or Harper's.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
But between these last couple, you really went MIA. So I'm curious, and which is a strange time for a man of your writing style and subject matter that you cover, especially in the years of our Trump, to just completely go missing. So what have you been doing? And
I've been working on this book
the whole time. Okay. Well,
oh, yeah.
Okay.
So, let me think now. So the last one, I mean, we can talk about whether I'm going to write. I'm not going to write another book about politics. Or not right away. Not right away, anyways.
Liar!
I'm so sick of it. I really am. I wasn't going to write this one. I did tell you that last time. I know.
Yes.
And then I went ahead and did this. But that was because my what happened was it went like this. So there are all of these books were coming out about populism, what a dreadful fascist thing it was. And I got so mad about it that I went and wrote a book review for The Guardian where I went after two or three of them, I forget how many. And my book editor liked that so much, and she knows that I know something about populism. We can talk about why I know all that. You know, but why I have all that knowledge, this useless knowledge in my head.
It's not useless. It's said, guiding us through the.
No, it suddenly became useful. Isn't it just the craziest thing? It suddenly became like helpful knowledge. Anyhow, she said, you got to write a book about this stuff. And I was like, no, I don't wanna. And she prevailed upon me and said, you got to do it. And so I did it. I signed a contract and I wrote it. And I spent, 2 years doing it, and I did it. I'm not a fast writer. You might think I am, but I'm not. And it takes me a long time to do this. And it took me about a year and a half to write this thing. And frankly, most of it was done in the very last part of that period. I did a huge amount of research on it. And, I've discovered all kinds of interesting things while I was writing it, in case you want to know. And I'll tell you about them. I mean, it's all comparison to, we have to take a step back here to the 80s. So in the 80s, I went to graduate school. I studied American history. And my subject was going to be populism. I was fascinated by it, that there was this radical movement in America, the would-be Labor Party of America that came out of Kansas, right? My home state. I was totally fascinated by it. And I started working on it in graduate school. And the research was very difficult to do, because to read their newspaper, they had hundreds of newspapers, if not thousands. Every small town in the Midwest would have had a populist newspaper. Mm. And it would be some kind of homegrown operation, very poorly funded, that existed. It's sort of like a blog now or a Twitter account, just to sort of troll the Republicans or something like that. So every town had one of these, right? So I go to read them. They're very difficult to get a hold of. You have to read them on microfilm. It's really unpleasant, sitting there reading the microfilm and the microfilm reader in the darkened library. And then I discovered that everybody else was also interested in populism. Again, this is in the 80s. Every graduate student was writing about it. It was like, and I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to find an angle of this that's actually original. And so I gave up on that and went on to a different subject, which was, the advertising industry, almost a completely random shift, but that worked out, right? So the advertising, well, anyhow, so I never looked back and I went on. And all of a sudden, now it's become this, this red hot topic. I look up here in the year 2017 or 18 or whenever that was, and everybody is talking about it, but they're talking about it in this weird way. It's as though they've never heard of the people who invented the word. They've never heard of this movement from Kansas that I was researching back in the 80s and that everybody was researching. Now all that everybody is like, disappeared beneath the surface without a trace. And there's this, huge and very voguish, very popular political science literature on the subject that has nothing to do with with the stuff that I was researching back in the 80s. Isn't that weird?
And I wanted to get into that because, obviously this is your new book that just came out is the history of this whole thing. But, I'm curious, can you define populism for the good listeners at home, but also talk about what is it, why does the MSNBC New York Times crowd want it to be something else? Right. Why do they want me to believe that there's one form of populism, it's Trumpian, it's the mob,
it's bad, or it's Marine Le Pen,
right?
It's Jair Bolsonaro. It's these really, really bad people. It's authoritarian bigots,
right?
Basically, that's how they define it.
Which doesn't reflect the popular.
It has nothing to do with what the the thing in Kansas.
So what is that with these? Is that ignorance or is it cynicism or what? Where does that come from? Why do they despise this?
Well, that's the question of the book. That's what I try to answer. We should say the title. By the way,
it is called "The People Know."
Yeah,
a brief history of anti-populism. I'm glad to see that your publisher got the punctuation a little better on this one than Listen Liberal.
Yeah, it looks good. It's a good cover too, by the way.
It's a great really like cover. And I have to admit, in the interest of full disclosure here, I haven't read the book in its entirety yet because you'll appreciate this. I ordered it to be delivered to my local mom and pop bookstore, but now I have to actually go pick it up. It didn't come in that little Amazon box, which I swear to God, I'm going to get over there and get it this week. But I did read the excerpt that was in Harper's, and you know, obviously I'm familiar with you and your writing. So I think I,
all right,
let's jump into the book.
It's not going to be what I say. Well, maybe it is going to be a huge surprise to you, but you put your finger on the essential question right at the start, which is how do we go from this movement that were, you know, the good guys, that's what populism was in the 1890s, the good guys. How do we go from that to populism as the sort of worst guys of all time? I was watching a TV, a documentary about World War II the other day, and it referred to Hitler as a populist. I know. It's like, oh my God.
Can it get,
you know, soon it's going to be like, well, Satan was a well-known populist, you know? So how does it go from one to the other? And these are a lot of these. So, you know, so right off the bat, I should admit a lot of these scholars who write about it are Europeans. And so they don't really know about the, you know, where the word came from and what the word means in the United States. And so I'm willing to forgive them that. But you know, we'll get into it in a minute and you'll see why that's, I really shouldn't let them off the hook. They really should be held responsible. But a lot of them are Americans. And a lot of them are scholars who might be Europeans, but they teach here in America. They work here in America. They have no excuse for not knowing where the word came from, that it was, that it once had a very, very different meaning. So my own definition of it, so I describe in the book two things. The populist tradition in the United States, this is a book that is only about the United States, the populist tradition in the U.S., and also the anti-populist tradition in the U.S. And so it's my idea of a dialectic, you know, like Hegel, right? Right. It's a, you know, you have one thing, you have a thesis, and then you have the antithesis, and then you have another thesis, and then you have another antithesis, and it goes on until you get to the shitty, shitty present. that's the conclusion of my dialectic is the awful place where we are today. But it starts with the good guys in they were farmers, radical farmers in Kansas and all over the Midwest and all over the South in the 1890s. And they got together and they were in, you know, terrible economic position. Their position kept deteriorating. And they got together to figure out what they could do about it. They set up, you know, a bunch of co-ops. They tried to do all of these sort of private sector solutions to their problems, and nothing worked because they didn't have any political power. And so they finally decided to go into politics, and they developed a reform sort of, what do you call it? A manifesto, a list of things they wanted to do, and went into politics as a third party. And I'm much simplifying the story here, but the third party was, very radical by the standards of the day. They wanted to, among other things, they wanted to nationalize the railroads. They wanted to change the currency. At the time, the U.S. was on a gold standard, and the gold standard was deflationary. It was really harmful for farmers and anybody who borrowed money. It was, you know, the gold standard is a famous disaster. That you would never wish upon a modern economy. It's just it's a terrible idea. And, did you just hear that noise?
No, okay.
It's just junk email. Let me turn it off.
Okay.
And they wanted to do a couple of other things, various federal programs to help farmers. They wanted the 8-hour day for workers. They wanted votes for women. They, like I say, they were very progressive, even radical by the standards of their day. And they reached out to labor unions. So the idea was a farmer labor party, which is kind of a familiar idea. And it was more or less you know, that at the same time, the Labour Party was coming up in England and in Australia, and in, you know, like there was a socialist party in Germany was getting started. These were happening all over the Western world. We're the only country where we suppressed it here in America. We beat them down, right? So there is no populist party anymore.
Well, and that's a tradition that has endured through the ages.
Yeah, well, the tradition lives, but the party itself was crushed.
The tradition of suppressing,
the left wing alternative.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's a, you know, a fine American tradition. Anyhow, so these guys get started, and they start off with a tremendous bang in the state of Kansas, and they come out of nowhere to defeat the Republican Party, who are the dominant party then as they are today in the state of Kansas, and they defeated them. It came out of nowhere, like I said. They called themselves the People's Party. And once this caused headlines all over America, it was shocking. And all of a sudden, people all over the country wanted to start up their own chapter or their own state, you know, People's Party. And it caught fire. They had a convention in 1891. And on the way back from that convention, a bunch of guys were riding on a train between Kansas City and Topeka, about 20 miles from where I'm sitting right now. And they came up with the word populist. They were trying to come up with a word to describe members of the People's Party or supporters of the People's Party.
How did you figure that out? Like the exact moment?
How did I do? I went and did the research. You know, what's funny is it wasn't that hard. I went and did the research on it. And this never appears in all these modern day works of anti-populism where they describe populism as fascist, et cetera, et cetera. They never do this. You know, they never go out and look up where the word came from. Never. And so I was curious.
Not shocked by that.
So I was curious about it. I was curious about it, and I dug a little bit. And because, like I said, because of the internet has changed how you do the research, it turned out to not be all that hard. Wow. It was mentioned in a article in the 1920s. It was a history of the Populist Party in Kansas, and he referred to articles in the Kansas City Star and in another defunct Kansas City paper, and I was able to find those on microfilm. But it's not microfilm anymore. It's all online, and you're able, you know, you pay some tiny amount, and you can look at these old newspapers. You can even do a text search in these old newspapers, and so I found out that the Kansas City Star would reprint this story every 10 years or so about how the word populist was invented, because one of their reporters was there. He was in the conversation. And so it was like his cocktail party thing that he told for the rest of his life. And so every 10 years or so, they would reprint his story about where this word came from. And so it was sort of locally famous a long time ago. But anyhow, so then the story of the Populist Party is it is really interesting. At first, it looks like it's going to be a great success. The economy goes into a tailspin in 1894. There's a terrible, they called it the Great Depression at the time. And there were enormous strikes, the Pullman strike in Chicago. There was the first ever March on Washington, which was organized by a populist. They called it Coxey's Army. You got all these unemployed people to march to, they called it a petition in boots. And Coxey got to Washington, and they threw him in jail for walking on the grass. This is, you know, the 1890s. There was like zero tolerance for this kind of thing.
The,
you know?
The original Zuccotti Park.
They let that go on for months. This was just, you know, no fucking way. Are you
stepped on the grass. You're fucking out of here.
Yeah, exactly. And it looked like populism was on the rise. And then in 1896, there's a presidential election. And what often happens in American politics happened. One of the two main parties changed and swerved and absorbed the populist sort of critique of capitalism. And in this case, it was the Democratic Party. And they met for their convention in Chicago. It looks like it's going to be, you know, populism is, the movement is growing and growing and winning more offices. They had members of Congress, U.S. senators, governors, all this stuff. It looks like they are the coming force. in American politics. And here come the Democrats meeting their convention in Chicago in 1896. They first thing they do is they toss the sitting president of the United States overboard, Grover Cleveland. They're like, nope, he's out. We're not renominating him. And then they say, we're against the gold standard. They come out against the gold standard, which is just an enormously shocking thing. And then like the next day, they nominate this guy, William Jennings Bryan, to be president. He's 36 years old. Nobody's ever heard of him. He was a one-term congressman from Nebraska who had given a very eloquent speech about the gold standard and the costs that the gold standard, you know, exacts on working people. A brilliant speech. It's remembered as the Cross of Gold speech. And he takes the Democratic convention by storm. They nominate him for the presidency.
Was he a populist, or was he just?
No, he was a Democrat. He was a Democrat. But then 2 weeks later, or a month later, whatever it was, a very short time later, the populists meet in their convention, and they're like, you know, shit, this guy's eating our lunch. You know, he took what was going to be our main issue. But you know, they have a whole bunch of other issues too. They've got all these other things that they're concerned with, and Bryan doesn't say anything about those things. It's just this one issue, the gold standard. And they say, well, you know, there's nothing we can do, so we're going to endorse him too. And this was very controversial. The populists fought all these different factions. Well, basically two factions: the faction that says yes, go with Bryan, and the faction that says no. But they do it. They get on board with him. It's a gamble. They think if he wins, and there's a real good chance he's going to win, because he is, after all, the Democratic nominee. He is this, you know, sort of instant celebrity. If he wins, we will get to, you know, have power in Washington, and we'll get to have guys in the cabinet and et cetera. So they sign on. And Bryan goes on, you know, the famous campaign of 1896. At first, it looks like he's unstoppable. But the Republicans, with the sort of genius of the business class in this country, organized the most incredible campaign against him, and they beat him. And that's a really interesting story for my narrative. And I'm not going to go into all the details of it, but what happens is a kind of hysteria among the ruling class of this country. The ruling class is not the right term. It's the establishment. So the journalists, the wealthy people of their day, the millionaires, leaders of business, from small business all the way up to, you know, Wall Street banks, come together with clergy, academics, economists, all of them, in this hysteria about William Jennings Bryan. I call it a democracy scare. It's a famous campaign. They went nuts.
Well,
they
were like, and it's also, I mean, there's the very clear parallels to what just happened in the Democratic primary.
And what's happening right now. I mean, right, there's hysteria that won't stop.
Right. I mean, it was engineered by the Republicans at the time, because he had won the nomination. So that's a little different than, you know, this time it was the Democratic establishment.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You're talking about the campaign to beat down Bernie. It's exactly the same thing. Yes.
Right.
And, you know, there's mass signing of, well, I don't, they didn't do a lot of mass signing of letters back then, but that, like, the Nation did a poll of the leading sort of scholars of America, all the famous academics of America. And not one of them supported Bryan. You know, all the leading clergymen of the day denounced him. And I went and did a sampling of the denunciation. I mean, historians know this, that this happened, but nobody ever writes about the particulars of it. You know, what they actually said about this guy. Mm. You know, why they hated him so much. And it is absolutely fascinating.
I mean, how do the accusations against him by the establishment compare to his actual policies?
Oh, you know what I mean?
Are they rooted in reality?
Well, they're rooted in one thing, which is that Bryan would have constituted, if you took away the gold standard and replaced it with what he wanted to have, a silver standard instead. The silver is a inflationary. There's more of it is found every year. There's no shortage of silver, whereas gold, there's very, very little of it. And so it's deflationary. Anyhow, we don't need to go into that, but, had he actually become president and been able to put that into effect, it would have been enormously harmful for bankers and anybody that owned, and it would have been really good for farmers and people who borrowed.
I'm curious, in that original wave of populism in the late 1800s, like to nowadays, there's you know, the left wing populism and right wing populism, you know, which are clearly very different, but are often lumped together. But I'm wondering, was there a right wing populism in the original era?
No, so I decided, Chris, after I wrote this book, that right wing populism is kind of a misnomer, because my definition of it, which is the American tradition of populism, is people of different races, different backgrounds, the whole idea of populism was to bring together the entire working class to reform capitalism. That was their definition. And there's a tradition of that in American life. And the right wing will often imitate that. So Trump talked that way. Trump pretended. Steve Bannon, Lord knows, talks that way.
Sure.
And before him, Ronald Reagan talked that way. Newt Gingrich talked that way. The Tea Party movement talked that way. But they obviously didn't mean it. It was, in every case, it was, you know, obviously a trick. And so there's, rather than calling it right-wing populism, I now think of it as just a kind of a phony. And we'll go into that later, okay?
Okay.
But there was no right-wing analog to Brian. There were right-wing hate groups at the time, lots of them.
Right.
But the populists opposed those guys.
Right.
Those people, they we'll talk about that too. The Southern racists. This was the great era where they were building up the Jim Crow system. Not great era, the awful era where the Southern, the racist South was coming together to crush things like populism. And it was the racists who were crushing populism in the South. And we'll talk about that in some detail. This is it's a well-known story, but no one would have ever called.
It's interesting how similar the critiques of populism, you know, even the language of it, were back then to today, you know, referring to it as like a mental aberration or what.
Yes. So exactly. So to go back to Brian, so the establishment press and the establishment politicians are showering him with abuse. And so I went through that campaign of abuse and looked at what they called him. And it's really, by the way, and I know I talk too much.
No, it's great. That's perfect for an interview.
The analogies between then and today, as you just noted, are exact. They called him mentally ill. They said this was a movement of people who had no business being in government. They called him a repudiationist, whatever that is, an anarchist. he was in favor of riot. He was in favor of mob rule. And they had this whole sort of image of him. And what it always came down to was, you know, that he was anti-intellectual. Right, that he was rejecting the advice of the nation's experts, the nation's bankers and economists, who said, no, you got to have the gold standard. That's what God says, you know. And Brian was rejecting this.
It is literally the exact same playbook.
Exactly. And so
iota.
So imagine me as I'm doing this research and I'm like, holy shit, it's the same thing. It's the same attack then as today.
Let me ask you a question
But wait, there's one detail that so Brian was a Democrat.
Right.
But the word that they used to describe Brianism was populism. That's, if you look at their cartoons and their pamphlets and their attacks on him, that's always the word they use, populism. Brian's particular delusion, Brian's supposed advocacy of mob rule and riot in the streets and the worst elements of society lording it over their natural betters, that's called populism.
Right.
And that's where this is the argument of the book. That's where today's anti-populism comes from. All these academics that are denouncing, Marine Le Pen, writing these books about what populism is. That's where their understanding of the word comes from. Here's the punchline. They don't know that. They haven't done this research. They have no idea of that.
It's interesting, though, because you said a minute ago that a lot of your peers, when you were in college and were researching populism initially, that it was a trendy subject.
Yeah, it was. This is long ago. Yeah,
where the fuck did those people go? Are they not the
they're still around. They
consensus wisdom thinkers of 2020.
Well, unfortunately, Chris,
they know better?
Unfortunately, Chris, I've got to instruct you a little bit about the sort of place of history among the among the social sciences. It is it is not a sexy discipline like political science and economics. It's not, historians rank real low on the sort of academic pecking order.
Oh, no.
And especially in terms of like who does the media go to when they want an expert on something.
Right.
It's not historians. And the leading historian of this, his name was, you would actually have really liked him, Larry Goodwin. He's one of the sort of guiding figures of this book. He not only thought a lot about populism, he thought a lot about the labor movement and how you build a mass movement of working people to attack, to criticize and attack capitalism.
Still alive today?
He died a few years ago. Okay. But he came out of the civil rights movement, and he was, doing his work on for civil rights and discovered that there had been an antecedent. He was from Texas. Discovered that there had been 100 years before, or not, well, 80 years before, whatever, there had been this movement that did very similar things, and he'd never heard of it. And he went out and did this research and wrote one of the all-time great books about populism called Democratic Promise. Anyhow, he's dead, unfortunately. And so there's no, populism has been the subject matter for all of the great American historians. Christopher Lash wrote about it. Richard Hofstadter wrote about it. C. Van Woodward, even W.B. Du Bois wrote about it. Nobody remembers this, but he did. Charles Beard wrote about it. All of them, all the big, the great names of the history profession, but all those guys are dead.
But Hofstadter was is
we will come to him. Yeah, he got it wrong.
Who defined it and was
right? Who misdefined it? Yeah.
But
so that's the next chapter in our story.
Okay. So I mean that's really interesting because what was so his they, book? Well, the they, Age so of that, Reform, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Working so they, class so they, authoritarianism.
Exactly. So they beat populism down in 1896. They beat Bryan. They beat populism down. Populism, after losing that election, the party falls apart in internal wrangling, and everybody's angry at everybody else, and that's the end.
It sounds like the left.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a internal infighting on the left is like as old as this country,
Right.
But yeah, they immediately fall to that, and the party it basically dies, and within 4 years there's nothing left. So, they hemorrhage voters and. They all go back to where they started, Republicans or Democrats, and a bunch of them become socialists. And the Socialist Party sort of picks up from there.
Mm.
Socialism was big in Oklahoma, if you can imagine, because of its populist background. Anyhow, so that's the end of that story. And then there's various other chapters. So I spent a lot of time in the book on the 1930s when you see the same thing happen again. Roosevelt and the labor movement use the language of populism. They don't refer to themselves as populists. The word in the 30s, the word was only used to refer to this historical movement in the 1890s. Mm. But they use the language of it and the strategies of it and achieve great success, do wonderful things, the New Deal. And they are targets of exactly the same kind of backlash as what met William Jennings Bryan. It's a coming together of newspapers, economists, academics of every form of orthodoxy, business leaders, all of this in 1936 come together against Roosevelt in this hysterical way, calling him a communist, a tool of Russia, all of this stuff. And there's these hilarious cartoons in the book you're going to see. Well, I'll just show them to you right now. Here you are. You can see them. I don't know if you're going to broadcast this or if people can see the pictures, but if you go to my website, you've got these great pictures of the democracy scare against William Jennings Bryan. But here's the democracy scare against Roosevelt. I love this one. The red jam of Moscow is all over his hands, And here's the beast of democracy, that is pulling the cart labeled New Deal. And it's a communist beast. But the idea of the people as a beast is always how they represent populism. It's the people as this kind of gigantic, colossal monster.
I think I pulled this from your book. It's a quote, "Populism for them is a one-word evocation of the logic of the mob. It is the people as a great rampaging beast."
Yeah, and that term, that idea of the people as a beast comes from Alexander Hamilton, or supposedly Hamilton was embarrassed by that and denied it his entire life that he said it, but
Or wait, no, it's not that he denied it. It's that, I'm sorry, but the quote is iffy. Anyhow, we don't know if Hamilton really said it, but it's the kind of thing he would have said.
But
you know, it's his,
well, that's
it's his idea.
That's good.
It's
enough.
His idea. Yeah. Anyhow, it's a term with, you know, whether or not it can be traced to Hamilton, it's a widely used phrase.
It's interesting for a culture like ours that has such seemingly absolute, like, historical amnesia. And not only do we not know what happened 100 years ago, we don't know what the fuck happened last week or in 2017 or whatever. And that is... That
someday is, we're going to find out, Chris Shiflett, and then you know what? No one will read the book.
No, but yeah. It's funny because it's interesting to put it to the context of what we're living through right now, because, like, that is a really, like a central part of sort of centrist consensus wisdom is we have
yes, to yes.
forward instead yes. of that, you know, and you're sort of ridiculed as, like, you're trying to fight the battles of the last 100 years or living in the past if you try to point out the fact that we've lived through all this shit
yep.
over and over.
Yes. I don't want to say history doesn't really repeat itself, but you do have patterns and you do have recurring episodes of hysteria where the orthodoxy and the elite and the press come together in this kind of airtight unanimity. Now, here's the twist. This is where the book gets really interesting. The first two democracy scares that I described, the one against Bryan and the one against Roosevelt, are obviously episodes of the right wing. In some ways, what we would today consider the extreme right wing. I mean, these are very racist people, both in the 1890s and the 1930s. The ones denouncing Bryan, the magazines that I took these cartoons from are unspeakably racist. I mean, just the most vicious attacks on Jews, blacks, and immigrants that you ever saw. These are the people denouncing populism, you understand?
Right.
The ones who denounced Roosevelt also, and they're like, there's no government should never intervene in the economy. Government cannot, you cannot have an income tax. The income tax was regarded as the beginning of communism. You can't get off the gold standard. God has ordained the way the economy is supposed to run, and we have to obey, you know, the dictates of the Almighty, et cetera, et cetera. And they did the same thing with Roosevelt. These are people on the extreme corporate right denouncing him and using eugenics, among other things, to show why, you know, working class people can't demand a better slice because, look, they're losers. Losers need to lose. You know, you know, the reason you're a worker is because you're a fuck up, right?
Right.
That's the reasoning. That's the logic.
I mean, very similar to the modern day version of that, which is, you know, fuck if. So what that your manufacturing job went away? Why didn't you just go to Harvard and write code?
Yeah, exactly.
You
know, exactly.
What's your fucking problem?
Exactly. So it was always these were arguments of the right. And then in the 1950s, a really interesting thing happens. It starts with the history profession. You know, we used to be important historians, and the greatest historian of the 20th century, his name was Richard Hofstadter, was a professor at Columbia University. And when I was younger, I have to confess here, when I was younger, I admired him. He's a great writer and a brilliant thinker. Could bring things together in a way that, you know, things that you wouldn't think of in a really original way, and I always admired him. But now I go back and read his books, and the truth sort of leaps out at me now that I know what I know about anti-populism. Okay, so he wrote a book in 1955 that was massively influential. It was called The Age of Reform, and it was a bestseller, won the Pulitzer Prize. It's been described as the most influential work of American history ever published. And, you know, it was a book of the month club, et cetera. It was widely, widely read. And the argument of the book does two things. It's it describes the history of reform in America, sort of like what I do here. And it's a manifesto for Hofstadter's generation, by which I mean the book is an attack on populism that says populism is not how, you know, the mass movements of working people, which he calls them all populism. So populism starts, he knows it starts as this thing in the 1890s, but he thinks populism now, he wants to use the word generally to describe all movements of mass movements of working class people and farmers. And all of these movements, he says, are
have these pathologies. They are paranoid. They are they have status anxiety, which means that they scapegoat people all the time. They can't really understand what's happening to them because they won't listen to experts. They're anti-intellectual and they're anti-Semitic. And this was all disproven within a very short time, but we'll come to that in a second. But anyhow, so he has this savage attack on populism, and which he has lifted directly from the anti-populist rhetoric of 1896. And he never acknowledges that in the book. This is what just leaped out at me now as I went back to reread it. I couldn't believe it. It's like you basically, Hofstadter, you've swiped this stuff. I mean, it's not plagiarism or anything. He just took the ideas from these anti-populist thinkers, this Republican campaign of 1896, and then you've just made it into social science. You've just cast it as social science. And the second part of it is that it's a manifesto for his generation of intellectuals. So this is the 1950s. People with advanced degrees are starting to run the great corporations. Instead of them being run by somebody who inherits them or who builds them up, an entrepreneur or something like that, they're now being run by MBAs. They're being run by, you know, a bunch of highly educated people. So are the departments of the government. They're not being run by, you know, whoever used to run them in the old days, a loyal Democrat or Republican. They're being run by PhDs. The Pentagon, even, is now being run by political scientists like Robert McNamara, you know, people like that. This is in the 50s and 60s. And this is what's, he looks at this and says, this is how you get reform. This is what a modern industrial society has to have. You have to have this highly educated leadership class. And this is how you get everything to work. It's not by having a mass movement of working people on the street. It's by having a bunch of people like me sitting around a mahogany table somewhere in Washington, D.C. and coming to agreement with one another. That's how you get it done. And this is, they called this the consensus, they called them the consensus intellectuals because consensus was their great idea that we all, that, you know, we all roughly, we all agree with each other here in America. That everybody in the ruling class in America agrees with each other on pretty much everything. And all we need to do to solve our problems is have us all sit around a table somewhere and talk it out. Does that sound familiar to you, Mr. Shiflett?
100%. I mean, it's
yeah,
it's stunning. So, I feel like I'm like repeating myself by pointing that out. But every single thing in the book and this whole
conversation, yeah, it chimes with what's going on right now. I mean, it's uncanny.
I don't know that that's a description of the current state of the Republican Party, but it's an absolutely on description of Democratic politics, yep, and the sort of culture surrounding them.
Yes, right down to the worship of consensus, which they do. They love that word, you know.
Yeah.
And but so Hofstadter set up this this binary. It's consensus versus populism. Populism is his word. It becomes his word for the what is not him. The anti-consensus. It's this idea. That's what, you know. That's what you want to avoid is populism. You want to avoid mass movements of working class people because they're pathological. Okay. Now, in this catches on in a huge way, and all the consensus intellectuals, and there's lots of them, like Daniel Bell, Seymour Lipset, Edward Schills, a whole bunch of them, sociologists, economists, all kinds of different consensus intellectuals, start using the word populism in this way. It's the pathology of working class movements, and they mean labor as well as farmer movements. They mean all of it. And they talk about working class authoritarianism. This is Lipset's big contribution to the idea. What's his name? Edward Schills basically talks about it as a form of proto-fascism. So populism, the definition is starting to change. But the guy who started this, Hofstadter, within 5 years, the American historical profession goes back and looks at his claims about the original populist movement. He's like, dude, you are full of shit. You're completely wrong. His book is refuted in this extremely convincing way. I mean, it's destroyed. All of his claims about populism were just like lying ruins on the floor. Like the idea that it's anti-Semitic. So this, there, a historian went out and was like, you know, did all this research on that very thing. I mean, it's all obscure, right? It's published in academic journals. There's no reason you would have ever encountered this or read it, but I happen to know about it because this was my field once.
I mean, do you think Hofstadter was what knew that and was
Oh yes, it was humiliating for him.
No, I mean did he know that when he was writing The Age of
Reason? Oh no, he didn't know that he was
peddling nonsense.
No, he thought, well, look, he was trying to do what all of us try to do. He had an original thesis. He had an original argument, which is he's writing after World War II and in the middle of McCarthyism. And so he's very troubled by right-wing movements. And he wants to find the roots of them. And he's like, aha, look what I found. You know, there's these sort of, I can trace it back to populism. And that turned out to just be completely wrong. And there was,
and it also laid the groundwork, I think, for what you wrote about in Listen Liberal, which is like the Watergate baby era of,
yes, this is where all of that starts,
who betray their sort of working class base. Ultimately.
Yes. Well, we'll come to that part of that's in the book too. It's all in there, my friend.
It's all in the book, babe.
Yeah. No, seriously, it's like I got it all in 250 pages. It was hard, but I did it. Anyhow, but yeah, Hofstadter knew that this had happened. It was very humiliating for him. There were books written just destroying this argument. Many articles written. There was a guy that did a book just about Kansas. I've got it here somewhere in this room. Just a book about Kansas populists, you know, proving that they weren't anti-immigrant. I mean, like proving it in the most, like going down to this in the most granular way. It's like, well, in such and such county, their county chairman was a Norwegian immigrant, you know, and in such and such right. county, their county chairman was from Ireland, and in such and such county, and it's like, oh my God. And he did a whole book of this, and it's just like absolutely devastating to Hofstadter's thesis. Okay. And Hofstadter knew this, and according to his biographer, it was you know really unpleasant for him. But the idea,
but in the great tradition of the intellectual
of American intellectual life, it doesn't matter at all. It matters. Who gives a shit? It never. It's like, as though it never happened. You know. The guys who did this, I think, are all either very very old or dead. One of the best books is by this guy Michael Rogan. He was a professor at, I think, Berkeley. He was a sociologist, and he was just like, he wrote like a 400-page book just trashing Hofstadter. And it's like, it's cruel. It's when you read it, you're like, oh my God. It goes on and on and on and on. And, you know, nobody knows that. Nobody knows that. So Hofstadter's redefinition of populism takes root. Or takes wing, I should say, and flies. And it's with us today. And there's now an entire academic discipline. They're all denouncing me on Twitter right now, by the way. It's kind of funny. They're all coming out of the woodwork and being, that's not what it means at all. You don't know what you're talking about. But there's an entire academic discipline that took its definition of populism from Hofstadter and has never acknowledged what happened to Hofstadter's, you know. So in other words, it's an entire pedagogy that's based on a famous mistake.
Mm.
And it's this pedagogy is everywhere. So when you read the New York Times using the word populist to mean fascist, that's where they're taking their definition. It's from this pedagogy that's based on this famous mistake back in the 1950s. It is a weird, you know, roundabout world that we live in, but that's where it comes from. So I was able to trace that idea, where that anti-populist idea. But the point that I want to get to, and that you're hinting at, is that anti-populism, this hysterical tendency that you saw on the far right in the 1890s and the 1930s, migrates to the left and is imported into the left. And the left, you know, the Democratic Party anyway, becomes a movement of people like Hofstadter, that generation that he was writing his manifesto for, the experts, professional class, et cetera. And they really do decide that's who should be running the country. It should, and they sever ties with, I mean, it all unfolds in exactly this way, and they sever their ties with working class movements, or is sever. They like their votes, right? They still like to get the votes of working class people, but they're not going to give them the time of day, and they're not going to help them build their movement, and they're not going to, you know, help them out in any way. You know, I'm talking about the labor movement here.
Sure, sure.
And it's. I do this survey at the end of the in the last chapter of the book where I you know, in the early Trump years, there were all of these people in the sort of BN, the right-thinking world of liberalism, who would do these surveys of dissent and protest through American history. And they would talk about all the wonderful protest movements in American life. And they'd talk about women's suffrage, and they'd talk about environmentalism, and they would talk about, you know, Stonewall and all of these different, you know, famous protest movements. And they, not only do they never talk about populism or, you know, farmer protest movements, they never talk about the labor movement. It's like, it's been, you know, erased,
right.
Erased from the history.
Well, it's such a fascinating time for, you know, the left and the Democratic Party, because, you know, the establishment, I mean, not that I would ever in a million years expect this from the establishment, right? But maybe the professional class base of support for the Democratic Party could have used Listen Liberal, your last book, or a couple of books ago, as like a context by which to understand and reflect on Clinton's loss in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And instead, they've spent the last 4 years with, you know, hysterical Russiagate conspiracy theories and things like that, that have produced really nothing. And but they have won too. I mean, they've
won. Look, Trump is such a fool.
And
such a bad president. They can't help but win.
Right. But I mean, they have triumphed over the progressive wing of,
yeah,
their own
well,
party.
Come on, Chris. You know that's not that hard to do.
I know. Well, yeah, really. Yeah, of course. But it's interesting. You know, it's like I can't help feeling.
That they're really not interested in that critique. And you started off this interview asking why I don't want to write any more political books, and you just, I'm sorry to say, you put your finger on it here, which is you know, I've been writing the same argument all these years since What's the Matter with Kansas, which is, you know, don't forget about your roots, Democrats. You know, you got to reach out to working class people. You got to keep their issues, you know, foremost in mind. You know, look what's going to happen if you don't. You're, you know, I've been saying this and over and over. And
sure,
it is, you know, it's like yelling at a wall.
When you consider, and this is a sort of a detail of the 2016 election that has, in I think, been largely overlooked, but I think is one of the more important ones. When you look at like the swing states that Trump won, and you consider the fact that there were literally tens of thousands of people in those states who supported Bernie in the primaries and ultimately voted for Trump in the general, that's something to explore, is it not? I mean,
is it something to denounce? Or is it something? Well,
and in my naivety, I thought that those people would come back to Bernie.
Yeah, because they want to win, right? They want to win.
And from what I've seen, they didn't in the primary. Those voters are sticking with Trump at least for the time being. But maybe they could be won back if you actually figured out a way to appeal to them.
Yep.
And I don't mean appeal to them through like racism and bigotry, obviously.
No, of course not. But by the way, that's always the there's this pattern of deliberate misunderstanding among these people. Like you say something like that, and that is what they would immediately think.
Right, you're a Putin puppet or a de facto Trump supporter or whatever.
Yeah, and the book ends with a chapter about modern day liberalism, which I just see spinning off into this, making no effort to correct its trajectory and spinning off into this professional class fantasy and hysteria. And I come up with a word for it, you know, a term, because they winning is not primary for them. It might be primary for Joe Biden and his immediate circle of advisors, but not really for the party. Is not about building a vast movement of, you know, the working people of the country, which is what every left movement and every left party in the world has been about. They're not about that. That is not of interest to them. And what is? And what what makes them happy? What makes them tick? And I finally settled on a phrase, the utopia of scolding. they live to shake their finger at people, and I thought of this after reading. You know, I hate
not
Twitter.
A good way to
hate,
win. Not a good
no,
way
no,
to win voters back.
I hate Twitter, and I try to go on there only once a day because it makes me so depressed and unhappy to go on there. But that's what it is. It is a kind of utopia of scolding. I live in Bethesda, Maryland. It's one of these places that has become, as the Democrats have taken over the sort of professional class vote, as it's gone from Republican to Democrat, Bethesda went from being Republican to being Democrat. And today it's like, you know, it was all so in for Hillary. I mean, I don't remember what her percentage was in that in Bethesda, Maryland, but it's extremely high, you know.
Right.
And it is a utopia of scolding. Every neighbor scolding everybody else. It's like everybody wants to be in some way morally superior or smarter or righter than their neighbor, you know, be able to disprove. It's like it's as though I sort of compare it to reality TV. Like if you're the rightest one, then you win.
Right.
You don't get voted. Everybody else gets canceled or voted off the island, but you, sure. the one who is the most moral and the most right on every question, you get to win. And that's the model of liberalism. And it's not a model that lends itself to building a movement for working people or doing anything for working people, except, you know, every now and then say, you know, we don't think that, you know, that the minimum wage should be that low. And so we're going to do something nice for you and we're going to lift it up. And there you go. You're welcome.
Well, but it's that thing should they get credit for, like, I've read some things about, like, you know, Biden being pretty good on labor issues or whatever, but should he get credit for that if he's also supporting trade deals that have destroyed people's ability to even earn a living? And
Biden is a supporting legislation. That's a different subject.
Well, you know, but I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we can just jump into that too. But the sort of the current political, like the current election cycle, I just think it's
the funny thing is that these guys are going to, I think they're going to win this fall, but
I think so too,
you know, despite themselves.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. Why is from a branding marketing perspective, why do you think Joe Biden, who is arguably more responsible for the worst excesses of sort of neoliberal
yeah. Oh yeah, he's, if you had to point your finger at one Democrat other than Bill Clinton, it's him.
And I think it was a fair critique of Hillary to hold her accountable for her own share of that. But really, like, she barely held elective office. You know, was in the Senate forever and has his name on a lot of really horrible legislation. Yes.
If you want to talk about, like, mass incarceration in this country, which is one of the
or banking,
the cruelest, you know, policies. I mean, it's one of the places where I just, that's, listen, liberal really came out of my abhorrence of that, of the mass incarceration.
Why is he not held accountable for that?
Well,
why does his
brother? I wonder about that all the time. It is well, for one thing, he said he's sorry, but a lot of it is because you know, I wrote this article for The Guardian asking that very question: why do people like him? It's a really good question. And by the way, people in D.C. love that man. Everybody has a story about him.
I have to tell you my story about him. I met him at a labor event here in L.A. years ago when he was vice president. And he was fucking insane, man. I mean, it was one of the strangest interactions. I met a lot of politicians over the years at various fundraisers and, you know, campaign events and things like that. And
what did he do?
He was so, I've never met a politician.
Did he rub your shoulders? Did he rub your shoulders?
He inappropriately touched my soul. He was like, hey man, nice to meet you, buddy. How's the band going? Like, you know, somebody just like whispered in his ear, this guy plays guitar for the Poop Buddy, or, you know, whatever.
His eyes lit up. He had
just a manic energy about him. And that was before he had gone senile. So who knows?
No, it's really sad to behold him, you know, speaking from his basement. I saw him at the Democratic convention in 16. I was actually impressed by him. He gave a speech there that 90% of it is just the usual bullshit. But there's this part where he asks the audience to stop cheering. And then he talks about Trump's personality. And he has this insight, whether he came up with it or one of his, you know, speechwriters, I don't know. But he said that Trump's favorite phrase is, you're fired. And then he goes on about what that means to working people. And it was good. I was sitting there in the auditorium and I was like, that's actually, that's like the best thing I've heard today. That's the smartest thing I've heard a Democrat say, you know, in this whole damn convention. And he does say things like that every now and then. Now, as we all know, he's consistently voted the other way. He spent his whole life screwing these people. But so I wanted to understand it. I wrote this story for The Guardian. You know, like Bernie Sanders loves him. Bernie Sanders endorsed him in this really unqualified way. You know, like,
I mean, you could say great. That's a big part of sort of the ultimate failure of Bernie's campaign was his unwillingness to destroy Biden when he had the chance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. Anyhow, but I wanted to understand that because they're friends. Why is Bernie friends with this guy? And there's all these unions that endorsed him real early on. And so I talked to the president of one of them, the firefighters union, and I'm blanking on what he told me in the article. But basically, he said, you know, Biden has really supported their issues. He's always been really supportive. You know, and we went on down the list, and I've talked to other labor people about leaders of, you know, unions, why they like him, and they, you know, they think his heart's in the right place. But the funny thing is they have two choices, right? They have Bernie, who has a 100% lifetime rating from the AFL-CIO, and they have Biden, who's like an 80%. You know, are you going to choose the A-plus guy or the B-minus guy? They are like, oh, every the B-minus guy. Yeah, you know.
That's our guy. I mean, but that's exactly what I was asking. Like, why? Like, these aren't stupid people. Like,
a lot of it's tactical. They want to be on they want to choose the winner early on,
right?
You know?
But and, just because he supports some of their issues, if he supports other issues that destroy
that have them, ruined them, have destroyed their membership.
Why do you get credit
bad?
For that.
Yeah, yeah. And they'll say things like, well, he was just being a good Democrat. He was doing that because Clinton told him to, or because Obama told him to, and. I have heard – now, I've never met Biden. I'm one of the only people in D.C. that's never met the guy. But other people have told me that as well, that he will do whatever the Democrats – you know, whatever he senses.
You know, I interviewed Matt Stoller yesterday, and thank you for connecting.
Well, what did he say? What did he say? Great.
But interestingly, he said in regards to Biden that that, in fact, during the Obama years, that Biden's team or people or, you know, whoever were around him at the time were consistently the more – left-leaning.
They were the progressive ones in that administration. Isn't that funny?
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. And
which I guess is that's hopeful, right? Yeah, but it's not hopeful when you see him, you know, working with somebody like Larry Summers. So it's to
right.
Me,
and his right-hand man was this guy called Ted Kaufman, who was really good on the bailouts and the Wall Street banks. I mean, was like one of the toughest guys going up against the Wall Street banks in the days of the financial crisis. And, you know, so there is some reason to be hopeful, but I don't want to go overboard with that. Look, he's a lackluster candidate. There's clearly something, you know, he's losing his rhetorical ability. I mean, I talked about that 2016 speech. That was a good speech. He was on the ball. He was sharp.
Yeah.
And that's gone. There's something's happened. And that's not good for a politician. And in any other circumstance, this would not be a wise move for the Democrats, but I think this pandemic is giving it to the Democrats. There's no way. I mean, Trump can't win the virus is out of control. You know, I'm here in Kansas City. People won't wear masks. They just won't. And they complain about people getting sick, and there are people getting sick all around here.
Right.
And I go on the neighborhood listserv, and the debates are they would be funny if it wasn't so awful. It's, you know, and then 15% unemployment. I'm sorry, you don't get reelected when that's happening. You know,
I just can't as hopeful as I am that Trump will be routed in November. And I share your lack of enthusiasm for a Biden administration, obviously, but I'd like to see Trump go. I have an uneasy feeling that these people are going to make it a closer race than it should be.
Yeah. We're still a couple months out. Anything can happen. You know that. But before this came to pass, I was quite certain that he, you know, the way the economy was going back in February, I thought this guy had a real, or Trump that is, had a real good chance of being reelected.
Sure. Sure.
But no, it's, this is a, just an incredible disaster. And I don't see how he survives it unless they find a vaccine immediately or something like that. So, but anyhow, let's game this out a little bit, okay? So let's say it happens according to what we've just been suggesting. Trump is gone. Biden is in.
And nothing other than that, nothing changes, which Biden has actually promised to his donors. Yeah. Nothing will change. It's status quo ante. We go back. Yeah. We go back to the Obama years. Nothing changes. Nothing changes. This is not going to end. This cycle, the cycles and cycles that I've been writing about my whole career, they don't end. It just gets more extreme on the Republican side, and more consensus on the Democrat side.
This is the delusion of the professional class liberal, is to not understand that ultimately a Biden victory, which they're going to be waving that flag, yay, we've won. All you're doing is setting up the Josh Hawley 2024 campaign,
or the Tucker Carlson,
or Cotton, or one of these other assholes. You know what I mean? Yep.
Cruz.
That is the danger of not dealing with Trumpism.
Exactly. And they'll never deal with the underlying problems that gave you Trump. Never.
Right.
I mean, maybe they will. Maybe I'm completely wrong and Biden's going to bring in Bernie Sanders and let Bernie Sanders make him chief of staff and let him run the show. And maybe that'll happen. And maybe but look, I think that what is happening in this country is, and this is, you know, like I say, my last book about politics, you know, whatever.
Sure.
I'm going to stick with that for now. And what this book documents is an inversion, an idea of the right that is absorbed and held aloft and treasured by the left. You know, this idea of anti-populism. And that is part of this larger inversion, the same inversion that had Hillary Clinton winning Orange County in 2016, Hillary Clinton winning upscale suburbs all over America that used to be Republican. And meanwhile, the Republican Party taking more and more and more of the working class vote. To this point, basically only the white working class, but you know, you give them a politician who's not a bigot and a fool, and they'll start branching out.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you know, political parties evolve and switch. Like,
what's happening right now.
Do you think that, like, if the Republican Party, because even Trump, you know, sort of was to the left flank of Clinton on a whole range of stuff.
That's right. Which is the Democrats have never come to terms with.
Right.
They got outflanked on the left on a whole bunch of things.
Do you think if they drop the sort of horrible nativist, racist, bigot, anti-immigrant part of what they do, which seems like they almost kind of have to at some point if they want to continue to be a party, but with changing demographics and whatnot. But do you think if somebody comes along and does that, will they out progressive the Dems to?
No, I'm not saying that they'll become
you and me would wind up voting.
No, it's people like you and me are just not going to have a party anymore.
Right.
No, it's not that they're going to adopt our position. Come on.
All right.
You're so optimistic, you know. It's just people like you and me are going to be left out. No, the Republican Party is going to remain the Republican Party. I mean, they might give you things that seem good. Like they might. So you mentioned Stoller a minute ago. Stoller's really big on antitrust as the sort of one of the great traditions in this country. And he's right about that. It is a great tradition that's been forgotten and lost. And we could, oh my God, you look at Amazon these days, you look at some of these other companies, you're like, holy shit, we got to bring that back, you know? And it's very possible that you could see Republican antitrust people out there. And so they would have something for you, but they wouldn't have the whole program, you know.
Right.
And the Democrats would have something for you also, you know. They're anti-racist and they're good on some other issue, you know, on a couple of other things. I'm talking about like years.
They're
down,
anti-racist
years down
rhetorically.
The line.
I would argue that in terms of policy.
Well, yeah, they also have a lot of really, you know, mass incarceration for God's sakes. You know, they got that.
Let's not forget Joe Biden, good friends with Strom Thurmond gave a eulogy at his.
I mean,
you can't make this shit up. I mean, it's for the moment we are having in history.
They found a guy who was pals with segregationists, and they're running him for president in the year 2020.
Right.
It's like, what?
I know it makes your
head. Where the hell did that come from?
Here's the question moving forward, Tom. Like, what should the populist left or progressives or however you want to define, you know, the sort of Bernie wing of the party nowadays, what are the lessons that they should learn from the old school populists of the past to move forward? You know, they came close this time, but they didn't get there. They got outmaneuvered by the establishment. Well, how can they produce a candidate? And I guess maybe also, who do you see that candidate being?
Okay, so the critical lesson is that it's not about candidates. It's about movements.
Right.
It's about social movements. This is how you bring change in this country. Candidates are a lagging indicator. You know, Roosevelt was great, but he had the labor movement organizing behind, you know, he had them at his back. He had this enormous mass movement going on. You know, Bryan, really good guy, by the way. I admire Bryan in a lot of ways. But what really mattered back then was the farmers coming together in this mass movement. You know, it scared the hell out of people. Mass movements get the goods. Hofstadter's completely wrong. The Hofstadter thesis is upside down almost completely. It's mass movements that get things done, not a bunch of professionals sitting around a table in Washington making sure that the economy, you know, adjusting the knobs on the economy.
Did the Bernie campaign create a mass movement? Is there a mass movement?
No, they tried. I like Bernie Sanders a lot. And one of the things I like about him is he's one of the only politicians that gets this, that you have to have a mass movement to get anything done. Now, people talk about mass movements today, but the only thing I've seen that even comes close to resembling what I'm talking about is Black Lives Matter. And they haven't gone into, and they have a populist streak to them, but they haven't gone into the economic question. You know, they haven't become a true populist movement yet, because they're not about, you know, taking on, you know, a movement of the entire working class taking on capitalism. That's not what, they haven't come to that yet, but they might. But I don't really see that anything like that on the horizon now. But, you know, look, Chris, I've been writing these books for a long time, and all that time my friends have been telling me, well, you know, Tom, back in the 1930s, you know, labor sprung out up out of nowhere, and it caught fire very rapidly, and it, you know, swept over the country, and et cetera. And all those friends are now, you know, we've all got dentures and our hair is gray. I'm sorry, that was a really mean thing to say. I go back and forth, Chris, between being, you know, optimistic about things and really, really, really pessimistic. And the populist way is to be optimistic. And that's why I'm not writing anymore. I can't do this anymore.
Okay. Now, your next book's going to be about cancel culture, because can a populist movement be built out of this period of the left embracing all these sort of puritanical?
Of course not.
Ideological.
That's the opposite. That's the opposite impulse to populism. Populism. Right. That's the utopia of scolding. So the, right. Remember, I referred to the great historian of populism, Larry Goodwin, before, and Goodwin not only studied populism, he tried to theorize it, not in the way that your global populism studies is doing right now. He's in a completely different field, and they don't ever talk about him, by the way. But he tried to theorize populism and how you build a populist movement in the American tradition that I've been talking about, like a labor movement or the civil rights movement or something like that. How do you build such a thing? And one of the terms that he used, you know, how do you work with ordinary working class people to build a movement? Do you scold them all the time? Do you tell them how wrong they are? No, he said you have to have what's called ideological patience. This was his term, ideological patience, because a lot of these people, they haven't gone to university. They haven't learned the lingo. They don't know the buzzwords. They don't know what they're supposed to say. They're just, you know, they're just humans. And they live in a democracy. They understand that. They understand all men are created equal. All people are created equal. They get that. But they don't, you know, no, they're not members of the professional class. And if you want to build a mass movement, this is who you have to work with. And so you have to have ideological patience. You have to teach them. You have to slowly, and the populists were very big on this, by the way, on mass literature. They would, you know, cheap versions of left-wing books. They had lending libraries all over the country. Their newspapers, you know, they set up universities and stuff. They would have, you know, remember, you know what Chautauqua is? It's this Midwestern thing.
They would have
speakers. Actually a street right by where I live, and I've always wondered where it comes from. So
it's a town in upstate New York where they developed this idea of having of mass education for ordinary people. They'd bring lecturers on important subjects out to a small town in the middle of Kansas, and the farmers would come from all around the countryside, and they would camp there.
A populist TED talk.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And they would camp there for a week, and it was sort of evangelical. It had a kind of a sort of church overtones to it. But they would come there and listen to these guys for a week. And populism did this. They would have huge encampments. And Chautauqua was very similar. And the Socialist Party did this at first also. Huge encampments where people would come and hear these speakers. And the idea is not to judge ordinary people. It's to help them. Bring them together. Cancel culture is about subtraction. It's about being the last man standing. You know, the last one who doesn't get ordered off the island, and then you win, right?
Right. And the last man standing having the utmost.
You've canceled everyone else.
Right. Do you see any elements in the left that are embracing what you're talking about? You know, trying to have the ideological patience. You know, I know there was that letter the other week in Harper's that got all that hoo-ha.
That was about free speech stuff. Ideological patience.
But I just mean in terms of a pushback on the sort of cancel culture and ideological rigidity that you see so much of in the left these days.
Not yet. I see there's journalists pushing back here and there. But the critical thing is this. Ordinary Americans... before they called it cancel culture, there's another name for it, like woke cultures. I forget what. Anyhow, there's a study done a couple of years ago about people's attitudes toward this, and Americans overwhelmingly hate and fear this stuff for obvious reasons. They think it's going to, you know, they're going to get in trouble at work or something like that and get fired. They overwhelmingly hate and fear this. It's not a great way to run to appeal to millions of ordinary citizens. I don't see any sort of organized pushback yet. But this is all new. We'll see what happens. But in the meantime, I'm off to Colorado. I'm going to go mountain climbing, and when I come down, I'm going to write a completely different book on a completely different subject. And you'll be like, "Whoa! I used to know that guy. What's he doing?"
I'm making a prediction here. No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
As an amateur historian, I take lessons from the past, and I'm applying that to your writing.
You and me both, my friend. I live in the past, man. I'm like, look around me. I mean, it's like I'm down in the basement yesterday. Exercising and here's a World War I helmet, I'm looking over here. I've got a Remember the Maine, a candy dish that says Remember the Maine, the battleship Maine. I've got the Les Miserables. I've got a World War I encyclopedias. The past is, the Faulkner thing, right? The past isn't even past for me. It's right here.
Right. Well,
there's Stoller's book. Do you see?
Yeah,
the bright red one that
I love it. Just finished it. It's great. Highly recommend it to anybody listening. I made a pact. Well, I thrust it upon him yesterday in our interview, and I'm going to make the same one with you. Is that next time? Because I read so much more than I retain. It's impossible. There's so many details.
I know.
So when you get into arguments at Thanksgiving dinner with all your neoliberal, hardcore professional class Democrat. Friends and family, I'm always at a loss for Pelosi's voting record or whatever thing you want to sort of use to make your point. So I am going to call you from now on. Put you on speakerphone. Stoller too, depending on the subject matter, and go. I'm going to tap out here and hand it over to Tom Frank, who's going to shut you folks down because he knows, goddamn.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. That's funny. No. I so want to be done with that stuff. I've just I'll tell you. Your listeners don't want to hear about like what I want to write about, but
Of course they do.
Because this one is really good. You know, I'm currently, I'm talking about this one. And I think this is one of the best things I've ever done. I'm very proud of it. And it's my only book with color illustrations.
Ooh.
Yes. And you can see a bunch of them on the website, tcfrank.com. It's nice. All of these political cartoons from 1896. And they're just incredible, you know, depicting Brian as Satan. There's one that, I mean, I'm trying to flip the definition of populism that all these people are using. And one of the things that they always say is that, oh, populists, they're really anti-immigrant, right? One of these cartoons depicts Brian as an Italian immigrant who has just knifed Lady Liberty. And she's lying dead on the ground. And the caption is, the assassin.
Right, yeah.
It's like, okay, look at that. Just look at that, okay? Just look at that for a couple of minutes and then tell me again that populism is anti-immigrant.
Well, you know? Tom, I suspect that this book won't get me invited to many. Right, I don't see you getting invited back on the Rachel Maddow Show at this point, but I'm glad you wrote it, and I'm really, really looking forward to reading it.
It's a good book, and you're gonna enjoy it.
I'm sure. Thanks for doing this today, buddy.
You got it, man.
All right, that was my good buddy Thomas Frank on Walking the Floor. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com, and I'll post some links to some of the things we talked about. And you can also go to tcfrank.com, find out exactly where he's at and what he's doing, and go follow him on Twitter, at @ThomasFrank_. He's been, like I said, he's been out and about from his bedroom, I guess, you know, via Zoom, out promoting his new book, The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Populism. So if you want to check him out, there's plenty to peruse. And buy his book. Do something people don't do anymore. Buy a fucking book. And buy it from your local bookstore and support your local scene. That's it for this week. I'll be back soon. Adios, amigos!
The bosses don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize.